Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today I want to touch on a topic that's very important, but it's a topic that I'm going to be dealing with in various ways. So today what we're going to look at is Britain and some of Britain's issues regarding colonialism and regarding race. So at the time that I'm recording this, the current Prime Minister of Britain is a guy called Rishi Sunak. And Rishi Sunak, as far as I know, is the first non-white to run Britain. I've not heard anybody saying anything about this. He's the first non-white person to rule Britain. And I think it's not good. I am all for a white Britain in the same way that I'm all for a white Europe, white America, white Canada, white Australia, and a white nation somewhere in Africa. But it's worth studying the things that have happened so that we can look at the long-term consequences of some modes of behavior. If we take a quick look at Rishi Sunak, Rishi Sunak was born in Britain. He was born in Hampshire. And his parents are Southeast African-born Hindus, so it says on Wikipedia. And it basically boils down to the fact that his mother is the daughter of an Indian billionaire, and his grandfather comes from present-day Pakistan, and his maternal grandfather comes from another place in what is now India. So Rishi Sunak basically is a product of British colonialism of India. But now his parents moved to Britain, he was born in Britain, and now he's a conservative. And it seems to me of late that white American conservatives and white conservatives in Britain have completely lost their minds. They are fooling themselves in so many ways. And I will tell you, I was no fan of Boris Johnson, the white guy who ruled Britain before Rishi Sunak. When I first heard of Johnson, I didn't like him, and people said that there's some kind of Jewish link there, etc. But as time went by, I must tell you that I like Boris Johnson more than any prime minister that Britain has had maybe in the last 20 years. I actually have grown to have a certain fondness for Boris Johnson. He's not a perfect person. He's quite a naughty boy. He's also a rude person. He's also just a downright nasty person at times. But I must tell you, Boris Johnson is the closest thing to a true white Brit ruling Britain that I've seen in freaking a very long time. I must tell you. What probably got Boris Johnson into power was that Boris Johnson was a great lover of banking. And Boris Johnson loved fighting for banking. So that's the secret to how he came to power. But in the end, he was beaten by a woman, a white woman, and then the silly white woman then quit. And then this Indian came to power. So the question is, how long is this Indian going to be in power? But this is a very, very bad sign. This is Britain's Obama moment, and it's very bad. I don't know of any European country that's been ruled by a non-white, but Britain might be beating everyone. And I have said for quite a long time that in my view, as I watch Britain, I think that Britain could end up becoming the Jamaica of Europe. The Jamaica of Europe, like a black overcrowded, non-white rat hole. There are many issues that pertain to Britain, and we're going to tackle a couple of them in this video and then return to this topic. It's part of a much deeper topic, but I want to point out a few things to whites quickly so that you can see some things. And I want to warn you people, you people have no idea where you are going with this tolerance nonsense. This tolerance stuff is bad news. And modern American conservatives, including Donald Trump, who one could argue was never really a conservative, and Brits, etc., these people think that they've got the answer to the problem of race. But I want to tell you, these people are making the dumbest, stupidest, worst moves known to man. And they are fooling themselves. The British are fooling themselves. The Canadians are fooling themselves. The Americans are fooling themselves. And bad, bad things will come from this. Another bad trend that is extremely prevalent in Europe, but you'll see it everywhere across Western civilization, is white women moving into higher and higher levels of power, white women ruling countries, white women even in charge of the military. I'm a total sexist. I am a firm believer in white society being ruled by white men. And the reason I'm a sexist is because of history. And the reason I'm a racist is because of history and science. And if you think that these things can just be shoved aside, ignored, etc., you're going to see what comes from this. White women are very, very weak. And white women can be fooled very easily. And once you start playing on them and playing on their emotions and the girl inside of their minds and in their hearts, you can start messing with these women. And these women are not strong enough to handle the ruthless, vicious competition of the real world. The real world, the natural world, nature's world, the world that God created, is a ruthless world. And in fact, in this video, we're going to be looking at some of that ruthlessness and what it achieved for Britain and what happens when the ruthlessness is gone. But the world is a vicious, ruthless place. And it always has been, and it always will be. That is the firm nature of this world. And the person who summed it up the best was Adolf Hitler when he said, "He who wishes to live, let him fight." Once you understand that, then you will comfortably be able to handle this world. I'm going to show you some of the weakness and morality of the modern world and how this is a problem for Britain. Technically, I was born in the British Empire. I was born in 1963. And in 1963, Rhodesia was a colony of the British. So I was born, technically, in the British Empire. Or rather, actually, in the British Empire. But in 1965, Rhodesia rebelled against Britain. White Rhodesia rebelled against Britain because white Rhodesians wanted to rule Rhodesia, a country in Africa. In that sense, Rhodesians were following in the footsteps of the Boers almost 100 years later. A lot of whites are fooled by a lot of junk that is spoken about liberalism and globalism. We're not going to touch on it in this video. I'm just going to tell you that liberalism and globalism is just a bunch of propaganda. And you're just hearing a bunch of slick propaganda, a bunch of garbage. We need to look at the world the way it is. We need to see facts for what they are. So it irks me tremendously that Britain was not a friend of Rhodesia or South Africa or Portugal. I very much am a staunch believer in the achievements of the whites in Southern Africa when we controlled five countries in Southern Africa, and when we fought against communism and we fought against black rule. In that sense, we were following in the footsteps of the Confederates in the American South, the people who were accused of slavery, etc., etc. And like them, we ended up losing, but we did not lose militarily, we lost politically. But these are things for another day. So I do have my irritations, my extreme irritations with the British, because the British make very weird moves. The British are hated in Europe, and I fully understand why the Europeans hate them. I've read enough history, I understand it. Europeans absolutely hate the British, even their so-called allies like the French, who actually were their enemies for hundreds of years, they detest the British. And I can understand why people have grown to hate the British. And it's because of the way that Britain functions, and I'm absolutely certain that at the end of the day, at the heart of Britain, the real cancer, the real sickness at the heart of Britain, I think, is the Jewish Rothschild family. I think they are at the heart of the sickness of Britain. Their great rise to power happened at the time of the Battle of Waterloo. When the Battle of Waterloo was fought, which was the last battle that Napoleon fought, though, technically, it was not the last battle that the French fought. The French army still fought one other battle after Waterloo, and they won. But the main thing about Waterloo had to do with the demoralization of the French. Anyhow, what happened was the Jewish House of Rothschild existed in a number of European countries, including France and Britain. And the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo could make you insane amounts of money on the stock exchange in London. And what these Rothschilds did was they managed to get information about the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo before anyone else. And what they then did was they went onto the stock market and they created a panic. And they pretended that Napoleon had won. And as people were panicking and selling stocks, these Rothschilds went and bought up everything. The Rothschilds may well have literally bought Britain in a very short period of time. With the panic that they created, they then picked up everything at rock bottom prices. They might have actually bought most of the economy of Britain as a result of that great trick that they pulled off. And the Rothschilds have been a great, great power in Britain. But they are very much a hidden power. They do not feature on the world's richest list. I have explained before why the Rothschilds of Britain are worth a minimum of $1 trillion, but they might be worth much, much more. Those Rothschilds might be the greatest private force of economics on the planet. But you will never see their names among the world's richest. I suspect, from what I've been able to pick up, that these Rothschilds go and they appoint agents in certain regions and they take over the economy of other regions. So in the case of South Africa, Cecil John Rhodes was the original Rothschild agent for South Africa and for controlling the mineral wealth of South Africa. When he died, the Jewish Oppenheimers were then brought in as the agents of Rothschild to take over the mineral wealth of South Africa. We will discuss South Africa and the great mineral wealth of the Boers as a separate topic. So I suspect that the Rothschilds operate through private deals that are not in public companies, through big-time agents that are in key positions all across the world. I suspect that the Rothschilds are so integrated with the British royal family, with the British upper classes, and with the British government, that it is very probable that the Rothschilds are probably totally protected by all the secret military services and spy networks and government military stuff. Because I think that the Rothschilds are at the heart of the expansion of the British Empire. And that a lot of the things that the British got up to, including waging war against the Boers in South Africa, that all of that was driven by economics. And that the British Empire is literally a case of Jewish business shenanigans teaming up with white European militarism. So in effect, the British Royal Navy and the British Army become a mercenary force for the Jews and the Scots, who became insanely rich as a result of this teamwork. So in other words, it looks to me as if the Jews, especially the Rothschilds, came up with all kinds of nefarious business ideas. And then the British military was then used to go and kill and conquer and smash whoever needed to be smashed, so that the British could then seize other people's stuff. And today, in the 21st century, the United States Navy, Air Force, and military is a similar thing. It is a mercenary force for Jewish business ideas, and off they go and they kill other people, and then the Americans grab other people's resources. Modern America is the new Britain, and the method of functioning is the same. There are three places where it seems to me the British struck huge profits. The one was in India, the other one was in China, and probably the lowest ebb of the British Empire in terms of morality has to be the Opium Wars, as well as the invasion of South Africa and the destruction of the Boer Republics. But today's topic is going to be a quick look at India and how things are backfiring now on the British. For a long time, the British conquered and controlled India, and India was really, really important to the British. When it comes to what the British actually did inside India, I've not really studied that. I've not really looked at that. But even in the time of Napoleon, India was of incredible importance to the British. And in fact, Napoleon proposed to try to seize India from the British. And that is why Napoleon went on his expedition to Egypt. Napoleon ended up conquering Egypt and conquering a chunk of the Middle East. Napoleon even went far into the Middle East at a point. And his original plan was actually to try and smack the British and to try and break the British links to India. And it was a plan that was approved by the French government at the time, because this was done before Napoleon became the ruler of France. He went and he proposed a military plan as to why it would be good to attack Egypt and the Middle East, and it was a plan that was aimed at harming the British in India and trying to cut the British off from India. So even back then, India was a critically important thing for Britain. Now the British made good use of the Indians, and the British even recruited various Indians into certain units of the British Army, and they used them in their various wars. And the British praised these Indians, the Gurkhas mainly, who fought for Britain. Now, I'm not somebody who's stuck on morals when it comes to the survival and expansion of our race. I view life the way our ancient ancestors viewed it, the way the Romans and everybody else would have viewed it, the Romans, the Greeks, the Spartans. I'm all in favor of white conquest. But what I want to show you are some of the negatives of the methods of conquest. And Britain is a perfect example. The Britain and India issue is a perfect example to show you the weakness of colonization of another race for financial purposes. Everything that whites have done, the good and the bad, can be learned directly from history. It's very simple and straightforward. You can easily study history and you can easily see over decades and better still hundreds of years what comes from certain kinds of policies. And the British India story is a perfect example. In the case of Britain colonizing India, you have a large country with a large native population. The British managed through a lot of shenanigans, through business as well as militarism and diplomacy, they manage over a period of time to conquer a huge subcontinent. So, from a white perspective, that is a great achievement. That is a fantastic achievement. The British have conquered an entire, highly populated subcontinent of another race, and they dominate them. They dominate them and they rule them. And it's amazing that they managed to do this to a subcontinent that is on the other side of the world. And they're doing this in the age of sail. So traveling there takes a long time. It's a long distance. It's amazing how the British managed to conquer India. And in European history, to my knowledge, India has only been conquered by Europeans three times. Now, whites and Indians have got some very interesting ancient links. The whites of Europe and the whites of Asia, because we're actually a people who originated in Asia, in what would be now southern Russia. Whites have, for thousands of years, had links to India and even China. But in this time, whites have conquered what is now India three times. The first people who conquered it were the Aryans. The Aryans conquered India, white people, white Asian warriors, went into northern India and conquered India. and controlled India for about 600 years. And they used a form of apartheid. They created the first ever true apartheid. And it remains to this day unquestionably the best form of apartheid ever created. Hitler was a great fan of the Aryans, and he thought very highly of the Aryan conquest of India. But the Aryans lost control of India, and it was through race mixing. It was through intermarriage. We will return to the topic of the Aryans and India. But the first and greatest, probably the greatest conquest of the Indians was the Aryans. It was probably greater than even what the British did. It lasted longer and it worked much better. And these were whites who functioned and went to war in chariots. The next conquest of India, but it wasn't a full conquest of India, it was a conquest of a chunk of India, was Alexander the Great, the King of Greece. Alexander the Great fought what you could call one of the earliest great race wars. And Alexander the Great fought from Greece all the way into India. It took him about 10 years to do it, and it was probably the greatest military campaign in history. In terms of distance that a single army fought, length of time that it fought, Alexander the Great's conquest remains unique. There is probably no European army in the history of the world that has achieved such a level of conquest on such a grand scale in such a short space of time. But Alexander the Great made many mistakes with his conquests, and so his conquests and his empire collapsed within 100 years. So we can say that the British conquest of India is probably the second greatest conquest of India by Europeans in all of history, with only the Aryan conquest being greater, more permanent, etc. However, the reason that the British lost is very interesting. And this is the great weakness of the British Empire. Probably no empire has the level of conquest of the British followed by the level of collapse of the British. The British ended up ruling something like a quarter of the Earth's surface, but they also lost it in no time at all. Unlike the Romans or the Greeks or the Aryans or any of the other Europeans who were able to hold on to their territories for long periods of time, the British collapse was massive. And that is because the British colonized for financial reasons and for political reasons without colonizing the physical territory. I've raised this issue of the physical colonization of a place before, and I'm going to keep coming back to that because you're going to see the critical importance of needing to settle the place that you conquer. And you need to settle it in large numbers. So in that sense, the British conquest of India, compare it to the British and European conquest of North America. The British and European conquest of North America was accompanied by mass immigration of British and European people to North America. And that is how they managed to totally dominate and become the majority in North America. The whites of South Africa, or the whites of Southern Africa, fit in the middle. There was no particular plan to really settle in Africa. And we in Africa are largely an accident of the requirement of Europeans to get to Asia. And when we settled in Africa, there were very few people here. There was virtually nothing going on in Africa. Plus, Africa was very disease-ridden. So there was a lack of interest, a lack of financial interest in coming and settling in Africa. And there weren't many people here. So the population explosion of non-whites in Africa is due to the local whites in Africa. We are responsible for the population explosion of the non-whites. And we, like the British, have ended up losing to others because we don't have enough of our own people. So in America, whites are the majority. In America and Canada, for now, whites are the majority. That is because they went there in large numbers, settled there, and could physically maintain a physical military presence there. The British went and nabbed all kinds of places and ran it from a distance and had some people living there, but the majority of the British stayed on living in Britain. And so that sort of colonization of another race from a distance, where you aren't breeding and physically controlling that country, that becomes a weakness. The European empires could last in Africa and Asia for a long period of time as long as it was Europeans fighting each other on a small scale at a great distance. But then came the big game changer, the Jewish communist takeover of Russia. And once the Bolshevik Revolution took place, and you now had this alien, anti-white, hateful communist system in place, this Soviet Union became the springboard for all attacks on white colonial territories everywhere. And after World War II, this process accelerated. And ultimately, that is one of the key reasons why the British not only lost India, but all of Africa. And by then, the British controlled one-third of Africa. And the British found themselves with a hostile, non-white populace. While the British military is too thin on the ground, the British colonists are too few, and they cannot fight against these vast masses of non-whites who've suddenly found a military supporter in the Soviet Union and later China. So the Soviet Union and China then paused the destruction of the European empires, including the British Empire. In fact, the British Empire was at the top of the list to be destroyed. So what I want to show you is the weakness of the British approach. The British approach of going and grabbing a place for its economic benefits, that works fine for a time. But one of the problems that happens that all whites engage in is that whites everywhere, when they colonize a place, they bring with them their science, their technology, their infrastructure, their knowledge. And while they are colonizing and seeing opportunities in other people's lands, they are busy building infrastructure and civilization in order for their own power and their own business and military stuff to become stronger. So they are not only grabbing things, but they are actually also creating possibilities that the locals were never in a position to engage in. So you could say that the British did go and colonize a place, and the British took a bunch of Indians and found a way to make them profitable and powerful. And that if the British didn't do it, the Indians would not have been able to do it. In the same way that if the whites didn't do it in Africa, the blacks definitely wouldn't have done it. Although blacks, modern blacks, think and imagine that they could have done it, which is just totally nuts. The reality is that those places would never have arisen to the level of European science and technology if whites didn't go there, didn't live there, and build and supervise and build their civilization there. In essence, what happened in Africa and Asia is that whites came, conquered people, then came and formulated a plan for the region that they've conquered and used the local people as their workers and told them, you must do this, you must do that, we are the law and order here. The whites create the legal structure, create the state structure, put everyone to work, and the next thing you know is there is a copy of a European civilization sitting on another continent on the other side of the earth. So you could argue that the British brought value to India that the Indians themselves would never have been capable of. And I would firmly agree with that viewpoint, because that is exactly 100% what happened in Africa. That if the whites never came to Africa, you would not have seen any of the stuff that exists in Africa today. And the blacks by themselves would not even achieved, not even 1% of what is in Africa today. They would never have achieved anything. And you can find examples to prove this. In the case of Africa, all you have to do is look at the only city that was close to a permanent city in Africa, and that was Timbuktu. And if you compare Timbuktu with what the English and the Boers did in South Africa, you'll see that there's no comparison. So when whites came and they Christianized and they came with their propaganda and their stuff and all these kinds of things, they came and they said to these locals, and I must add that part of colonization was also the Christianization of all these non-whites. And whites came to bring the Bible and all that kind of stuff to all these non-whites, teach them morals, etc. In the case of the Asians have got a higher IQ, they've been around longer, and they do have their own ancient stuff that they can look back on. So for them, they aren't that keen on converting to Christianity, whereas whites had much more success in Africa. But here's the problem with conquering another race and taking control of another race, is that if you do not come in large enough numbers to control your own system, and instead these other people breed and they become ever greater in numbers, and maybe your science and medicine also helps that, because that definitely happened in Africa, then what happens is you're actually taking another race of people and you're creating a nation that you are ruling, but you are actually taking this other alien race of people and you're making them stronger. You are teaching them things. You're putting them in schools. You're teaching them stuff. And if you eventually start teaching them and giving them positions, they will eventually rebel against you. And this happens all throughout history It is a recurring theme of history. And the ancient Greeks, who were white, civilized people, and who were great thinkers, and were active before the Romans, the ancient Greeks already knew the danger of making other people stronger. The ancient Greeks discussed this, and they knew that if you make other people stronger, those people can turn against you. And this is one of the big things of liberalism that everybody these days has forgotten. That if you go and you help others to breed, to have babies, you educate them, you make them stronger, you let them grow in number, that at some point in time, they can decide that they want to fight you. And that is exactly what happened to the British. And when it happened to the British, it happened right across the whole British Empire. And Britain lost everything. The British keep thinking in Jewish terms. They keep thinking in terms of business and economics. But that business and that economics is not possible without physical colonization, without physical infrastructure, without physical police and military power. And if you lose control, you could lose everything. And the British did, as did many other Europeans. Take the Belgians in Africa, in the Congo, where they were outnumbered 100-1, and then the blacks turn against them, kill them, and there you've lost your country. The bottom line is other people can rebel against you. And if they are of another race, they have even more reason to rebel against you. And they've got lots of local values, local things that are different and alien to you. So because I'm kind of irritated and I've got a chip on my shoulder against the British, I do sometimes delight when I see how black Africans and Indians are pouring into Britain and they are taking over Britain. And I say to myself, if only the British had listened to the Rhodesians and the South Africans, if only they had listened to us and what we had told them. Look at the path they are going down. And the whites in Britain are going to find themselves clashing more and more with alien races. And these are alien races that used to be in their empire that they now are allowing into their own country. And they are actually being counter-colonized in their own country. And a nightmare awaits the white people of Britain. And the fact that they've already got their first non-white Prime Minister, and nobody in Britain is turning around and saying, hey, we're busy going down, we're going down, we're losing our shit. British are in for a nightmare. And I personally think that the British are going to have a much harder time than the rest of Europe. I think the British and the Swedes are going to have the worst time of all in Europe. I think the other whites are in a better situation and can pull out of it better. So let us now look at the results of colonizing India and uplifting the Indians. Now, a thing to keep in mind is that Asian people are more intelligent than black Africans. We're going to return to the topic of IQ. Asians have a higher IQ than Africans. So what happens when you take a people who might not have looked that advanced, but they are of higher IQ, and you uplift them? In theory, it can help you when they are on your side. But what happens when they start turning against you? Then you might have a problem. I just want to clarify something. It is said that the British ruled India for 200 years, but in reality, it took the British quite a while to subdue all of India. and they only fully subdued all of India by 1849. And the British lost India in 1947. So technically, the British ruled India for 98 years. So we can round it and say the British ruled all of India, the whole of India, for 100 years. That is a great achievement, make no mistake. And it still remains the second greatest conquest of Europeans in Asia, with the Aryans beating everybody. 600 years of conquest and control. We will revisit the Aryans. They are the original creators of apartheid, and the best and most sophisticated apartheid that ever existed. An apartheid that worked so well that to this day it is in the Indian mind. Indians still live by rules that were created by the original whites, the Aryans. So nowadays, India is a major power in the world, and I think that India might even be more powerful than China. And I think the Indians are going to be very interesting to watch. They are a pretty impressive power. My favorite among the Asians are the Japanese. The Japanese are the number one Asians. I see them as the greatest of all the Asians. But I think the Indians might turn out to be number two. I'm not a fan of the Chinese, and I don't think much of the Chinese. So what I want to show you now is the results of colonization. Colonization, education, etc. What are these people like? And what do they say about colonization after all this time? Do they turn around and thank the British for doing things in India? In fact, not. The fact that those Indians today are better off than they would have been if they'd been left to themselves, that is forgotten. In fact, now they jump up and they say that Britain owes them money, that Britain has done horrible things to them. I'm not going to go into their history and into their complaints. I know there's talk of famines, etc. But I just want to show you what happens when you have educated them. You have gone and put a system in place that they are now living off. You went and organized them. You went and built an infrastructure, or you used their labor to build the infrastructure. But you were the brains of this whole setup. It wasn't Indians that thought it up. It was white British that thought it up. It was white British who brought their institutions, who brought their laws, who brought their military, who came and solved all the problems that caused India to become strong. And yes, the British did it for their own benefit. They went to conquer, and they conquered someone else and used somebody else for their benefit. And I personally don't have a problem with that. Whites have done this many times in history, and whites have done this to other whites as well as to non-whites. I don't have a problem with conquest and ruling. I don't have a problem with any kind of conquest by white people. I'm a big fan of conquest. I view conquest the same way that the Romans and Greeks viewed conquest. They saw it as a good thing. They loved it when they went and conquered others and took control. Our pre-Christian European morality said that conquest is excellent. They believed that. They had their reasons for it. And I see nothing wrong with that mindset. And here are whites in the times of Christianity starting to conquer. And they are conquering, but they are fooling themselves about how they're going to Christianize everybody, how they're going to teach them morals, etc. Basically interfere with the way they were living. Whites in Africa did the same thing. White South Africans, Boers, did the same thing. The British did it in Africa. The Portuguese did it in Africa. But let's take a look at how the Indians view this. How many Indians are happy and grateful about this? And you're going to see Indians who turn around and tell the British that they owe the Indians reparations, that they have committed crimes against the Indians. What you will find is that when you conquer somebody, no matter how well you rule other people, no matter how well you rule them, how many problems among them you solve, how many people's lives your doctors and your medicine and your science saves, you will find that at the end of it, they are ungrateful and they are angry with you. So what you're going to see after this for about 50 minutes is you're going to see a bunch of speeches, serious speeches, mostly made by non-whites, but it includes some whites with rebuttals. And you're also going to see some comedy where you've got Indian comedians, except for the one skit by that South African mixed race half Jew, Trevor Noah. But you're going to see either serious speeches or comedy. And remember, a lot of comedy includes truth. Many a true word is spoken in jest. What you are going to see is what comes out of their minds. How do they perceive the British? Now they are angry with the British. They have a lot of negative vibes towards the British. They are not happy and grateful and ready to embrace the British. Instead, they look on the British as being an evil force that came to their land. The fact that they would not be wearing those clothes or standing on that stage or being a part of European civilization, they take all of that for granted now. But look at them and look at the vibe that comes back from them and tell me if you think it's good, because I don't think so. I think that no matter what the British did, no matter what good the British may have caused to happen to India, those people don't like it. That 250 years later, those people are not thankful to whites for what's happened. Now, go back and look, let's say, at white Americans. White Americans, white Canadians, white South Africans, white Australians. And look back on their views of the original whites who came to their respective places and conquered and built civilization. So we in South Africa, we are proud of Jan van Riebeeck, who came to colonize South Africa. We are proud of our ancestors and their struggles and battles that brought us civilization in Southern Africa. White Americans, the ones who are not woke and have not lost their minds, but at least until recent times, the vast majority of white Americans were very proud of their pioneers, of their founding fathers, and of their heroes and their achievements. It is only in the last decade or two that they've completely lost their minds. But until then, white Americans were proud of being what they were. White Canadians were proud of their achievements. But when you create success for another race, a race that is biologically different to you, and you create success, you thrust success down their throats. You are busy getting something out of them, yes, but they are also benefiting from being associated with you. And look at them, that they're not grateful at all. And when I look at blacks in Africa, and I've looked at blacks from Rhodesia and from here in South Africa, and I see what they say about us, they ignore the fact that we saved them and prevented them from starvation in famines. They take for granted the vast number of children and people who are saved by our doctors, by our medicine, by our science. They forget all those things. They are angry with us and they want to rule themselves. If you look closely at this, you'll see that they now have a sense of nation and identity, that nationalism comes out the winner. They are not interested in globalism. They want to rule themselves, and they don't want globalism. And they're not even grateful to the British. So now they are angry with the British. And look at their comments. Look at the comments they make about white people. Look at the fact that they don't even look up to white people. They don't even say, you know, we used to live with a high death rate from disease, and you know, our children used to die young, we struggled with famines, we had all kinds of problems, and you came and made life better. You don't have any of that. They actually look at us and they look down on us. They look down on us. Look at the comments they make. And what I find horrific is that white people in the audience are sitting and laughing at themselves. White people, and also look at women, look at white women who jump up and attack their own civilization. And suddenly you find that this Christian morality is rebounding on you. All of a sudden, when you apply that Christian morality and you start saying, oh, everyone's equal and we must all work by the same rules, look at what happens when they point the finger at you. And even the non-whites who have become Christians, they can turn around on a dime and stick the finger right in your eye. I've seen that, especially in South Africa, big time. And so I look at these things and I say to myself, look at these people. Look at what they genuinely think, what comes out of their hearts and their minds. And look at how they look at the British. And the way that they are talking about the British, you'll see that blacks and non-whites everywhere behave the same way to the whites of South Africa, to other European whites, etc. That when you have forced greatness upon another race, that race hates you no matter how much good you did to them. No matter how much good you did to them, even if you saved them from destruction of themselves by themselves, they hate you. They certainly don't look up to you. They certainly are not thankful to you. And if they get the chance to make some snide remark or to make some kind of move that goes against you, they do. They are not your friend. Colonizing other races and teaching them our stuff is not good. This is something that has been tried before. I'm just showing you of what's happened in the last 200 years with India. But the ancient Greeks in the time of Alexander the Great went on a similar spree, where they even exported their science, their culture, their knowledge. I'm going to return to this topic where white people export their science, their culture, their knowledge, their values, their systems to other people. And the end result is not good for whites. For a time, while you have the power, you can control them, and they are loyal to you while you have the guns. The moment that you lose control, physical control of those people, and those people can challenge you, they hate you, and they'll turn on you, and they'll work against you. The white British have got a hard time ahead. The white Americans may have an even worse time ahead. It is a race to the bottom for Britain, Sweden, and America, probably Canada as well. It's a race to the bottom, man. And look at these people after a time. Now, there are those who are liberal who believe that the problem is you should have made them equal from the beginning. That is even worse. That's even worse. But we'll discuss that another time. But just look at this and look at how these people view the British. And you cannot tell me that this has been successful for the British. Those people, look at their behavior, look at their viewpoints. Now they are a nation. Now they have the ability to think and to speak. And what comes out of their mouths? And is it good for whites? And the answer is no. Look at their attitude to the British. If it wasn't for Britain, they wouldn't have the country and the infrastructure that they have now. But look at their attitude towards the British. And you tell me if it wasn't a whole waste of time. That in terms of the actual relations between the British and this other race, has it been that good? What is the end result? I don't think it's good. And I don't think it bodes well for the British at all. And I must tell you that I am horrified when I watch comedy skits where non-whites mock whites, and they do so in front of an entire white audience, and all the whites sit and laugh and denigrate themselves. I think that is a bad sign of serious weakness. White people have truly come to believe that they are everybody's equal. Yet, if you look at our history, that is not true. It was not true in the past, and it's not true now. But whites have totally lost pride in themselves, a belief in themselves. They've lost it completely. And I would not pay 1 cent to sit in that audience. Do I laugh at some of those jokes? Yes, I laugh at them. Yes, there are some funny things in there. But would I want those people to speak to me like that? And the answer is no. And until white people can learn to stand up for themselves as whites, as a group, that is a thing that we need to achieve soon. Because if we don't, we're going to lose everything. Though I do believe that we have what it takes to win. But I just want to show you that this kind of weakness should not be tolerated. And we need to start learning from these kinds of things that were done in the past. Look at this, reevaluate this, and say, what did the British do wrong? And what did the French do wrong? What did the Portuguese do wrong? What did the Germans do wrong, etc.? We need to look at our interactions with others and understand what they did wrong. But I will discuss certain of these things in other videos. But here, take a look at these modern Indians and what they've got to say about the British. And not one good word, I tell you. I'm a firm believer that whites should stick with whites, and whites should work together with other whites, because that is what is really bringing us down. And the key event that started this whole rotten process was Jewish Bolshevism in Russia in 1917. That thing was the true thing that suddenly caused everything to spiral out of control for whites. And as for Christians, Christians need to look at their morality and need to think very carefully about that morality. Should you be applying all that Christian morality to other races? Should you be treating them as your equals? Should you regard your dealings with them as being on the same level as that of your own race? We will revisit these things. Anyway, here's a whole bunch of videos. The one follows the other, and you'll see serious stuff as well as comedy stuff. And look at this. This is not good. And these whites in these audiences are very weak. Watch the laughter, watch the whites in the audiences who jump up and what they say. Very, very weak and pathetic. We have to up our game and we have to become a lot stronger in defense of ourselves.
A lot has been written and said about the British rule in India. If you read their version of history, you would think that the British Raj was the best thing that could have ever happened to India. But the fact is that the British looted India. A greedy and racist British Raj financed its industrial revolution by robbing India, and now there is more data to prove it. A study by Indian scholars reveals stunning numbers. The British looted as much as $45 trillion, let that number sink in, $45 trillion between 1765 and 1938. Just so that you get a sense of how big this sum is, let me give you another figure. The amount of money that the British looted from India, $45 trillion, is 17 times the current GDP of the UK, 17. That's how much India, which used to be one of the richest countries in the world, was reduced to one of the poorest. But defenders of the British Raj would argue otherwise. They claim to have given India democracy, a free press and the rule of law. They claim to have built the Indian railways, taught Indians how to speak English and even play cricket. A British research company, in fact, asked the citizens of the UK about this in 2014. What they found is astonishing. Nearly two-thirds of British citizens feel that the empire was something to be proud of. They did well, they believe. And that includes their politicians. They share this belief. One notable member of this club is a former prime minister. When David Cameron was in office, he was asked about his thoughts on the empire, and he said, "There is a lot that Britain can be proud of." The timing of the statement was even worse. He was visiting the Jallianwala Bagh in Amritsar in 2013. Listen to his comments, and I'm quoting. This is what the former British PM said. As I was asked the question yesterday, in terms of our relationship with India, is our past a help or a handicap? I would say that it's a help because of the shared history, culture, the things that we share, and also the contributions the Indians talk about that we've made. Contributions. No word on the colonial loot, no word on the misdeeds, the rampant abuses. That's a part of history that has been conveniently brushed under the carpet. It is a fact that British school students do not learn much about their colonial past in schools. Here's a quick eye-opener for them and for all those people who believe that the Brits helped India. This is what they did. The British imposed heavy taxes on Indian producers. The British stole goods and exported them around the world for a profit of 100%. The earnings were then used to finance imports of strategic materials like iron, tar and timber from Europe. These were essential to the industrialization of the Great Britain. Due to loot from India, Britain had an impressive trade surplus that lasted for three decades in the 20th century. In fact, most of the so-called hallmarks, like the railways and the British architecture in India, were actually built by the Brits for themselves, for their own use, to help their own interests in India. These were no gifts for India or Indians. Take the example of the railways. The British built the network for themselves. No two ways about it. They used their own technology. Indians were forced to buy British equipment and at high prices. The bill was footed by Indian taxpayers. We paid them for building all this. The British earned all the money. And now they want gratitude too. I'm afraid we can only give them numbers, and numbers they may not like. India's share of the world economy when Britain arrived on its shores was 23%. By the time they left, India's share was down to less than 4%. Why and how did that happen? Simply because India had been governed for all these years for the benefit of Britain. Britain's rise for 200 years was financed by its depredations in India. These are not my words. These are the words of Congress lawmaker Shashi Tharoor. Take a look at this.
It was a rare moment in Indian politics. Narendra Modi heaping praise on Shashi Tharoor for his debating skills. Modi was commending the opposition lawmaker for his passionate argument in the Oxford Union debate on whether Britain owes India reparations for 200 years of its colonial rule. The essence of Tharoor's submission was about the toll that British rule took on India's economy.
India's share of the world economy when Britain arrived on its shores was 23%. By the time the British left, it was down to below 4%. Why? Simply because India had been governed for the benefit of Britain. In Britain's rise for 200 years was financed by its depredations in India. In fact, Britain's industrial revolution was actually premised upon the deindustrialization of India.
Modi said Tharoor's speech gelled with the feelings of patriotic Indians on the issue and also shows what impression one can leave with effective arguments by saying the right things at the right place.
As far as I'm concerned, the ability to acknowledge a wrong that has been done, to simply say sorry, will go a far, far, far longer way than some percentage of GDP in the form of aid. What is required, it seems to me, is accepting the principle that reparations are owed. Personally, I'd be quite happy if it was £1 a year for the next 200 years after the last 200 years of Britain and India.
The debate was entitled, "This House Believes Britain Owes Reparations to Her Former Colonies." It was organized by the Oxford Union, a debating society in the English city of Oxford, whose members are drawn from the University of Oxford. And just in case you're curious to know who won the debate, well, Tharoor's team won the debate with 185 votes to 56. Bureau report, we on World is One.
President, and gentlemen, ladies of the House, I, standing here with 8 minutes in my hands and at this venerable and rather magnificent institution, I was going to assure you that I belong to the Henry VIII School of Public Speaking, that as Henry VIII said to his wives, I shall not keep you long. But now finding myself the seventh speaker out of eight in what must already seem a rather long evening to you, I rather feel like Henry VIII's last wife. I more or less know what's expected of me, but I'm not sure how to do it any differently. Perhaps what I should do is really try and pay attention to the arguments that were advanced by the opposition today. We had, for example, Sir Richard Ottery suggesting, challenging the very idea that it could be argued that the economic situation of the colonies was actually worsened by the experience of British colonialism. Well, I stand to offer you the Indian example, Sir Richard. India's share of the world economy when Britain arrived on its shores was 23%. By the time the British left, it was down to below 4%. Why? Simply because India had been governed for the benefit of Britain. In Britain's rise for 200 years was financed by its depredations in India. In fact, Britain's industrial revolution was actually premised upon the deindustrialization of India. The handloom weavers, for example, famed across the world, whose products were exported around the world, Britain came right in. There were actually these weavers making fine muslin, light as woven air, it was said. And Britain came right in, smashed their thumbs, broke their looms, imposed tariffs and duties on their cloth and products, and started, of course, taking the raw materials from India and shipping back manufactured cloth, flooding the world's markets with what became the products of the dark and satanic mills of Victorian England. That meant that the weavers in India became beggars, and India went from being a world-famous exporter of finished cloth into an importer, went from having 27% of world trade to less than 2%. Meanwhile, colonialists like Robert Clive bought their rotten boroughs in England on the proceeds of their loot in India, while taking the Hindi word loot into their dictionaries as well as their habits. And the British had the gall to call him Clive of India, as if he belonged to the country, when all he really did was to ensure that much of the country belonged to him. By the end of the 19th century, the fact is that India was already Britain's biggest cash cow, the world's biggest purchaser of British goods and exports, and the source of highly paid employment for British civil servants. We literally paid for our own oppression. And as has been pointed out, the wealthy Victorian British families that made their money out of the slave economy, one-fifth of the elites of the wealthy class in Britain in the 19th century owed their money to transporting 3 million Africans across the waters. And in fact, in 1833, when slavery was abolished, what happened was that a compensation of £20 million was paid, not as reparations to those who had lost their lives or who had suffered or been oppressed by slavery, but to those who had lost their property. I was struck by the fact that your Wi-Fi password at this union commemorates the name of Mr. Gladstone, the great liberal hero. Well, I'm sorry, his family was one of those who benefited from this compensation. Staying with India, between 15 and 29 million Indians died of starvation in British-induced famines. The most famous example, of course, was the Great Bengal Famine during the Second World War, when 4 million people died because Winston Churchill deliberately, as a matter of written minuted policy, proceeded to divert essential supplies from civilians in Bengal to sturdy Tommies and Europeans as reserve stockpiles. He said that the starvation of anyway underfed Bengalis mattered much less than that of sturdy Greeks. This is Churchill's actual quote. And when conscience-stricken British officials wrote to him, pointing out that people were dying because of this decision, he peevishly wrote in the margins of the file, "Why hasn't Gandhi died yet?" So all notions that the British were trying to do their colonial enterprise out of enlightened despotism to try and bring the benefits of colonialism and civilization to the benighted heathen. I'm sorry, Churchill's conduct in 43 simply one example of many that gave a lie to this myth. As others have said on the proposition, violence and racism were the reality of the colonial experience. And no wonder that the sun never set on the British Empire, because even God couldn't trust the English in the dark. Let me take World War I as a very concrete example, since the first speaker, Mr. Lee, suggested these things couldn't be quantified. Well, let me quantify World War I for you. Again, I'm sorry, from an Indian perspective, others have spoken of other countries. 1/6 of all the British forces that fought on the war were Indian. 54,000 Indians actually lost their lives in that war. 65,000 were wounded. Another 4,000 remained missing or in prison. Indian taxpayers had to cough up £100 million in that time's money. India supplied 70 million rounds of ammunition, 600,000 rifles and machine guns. 42 million garments were stitched and sent out of India. And 1.3 million Indian personnel served in this war. I know all this because, of course, the commemoration of the centenary has just taken place. But not just that. India had to supply 173,000 animals, 370 million tons of supplies, and in the end, the total value of everything that was taken out of India. India, by the way, suffering from recession at that time and poverty and hunger, was, in today's money, £8 billion. You want quantification? It's available. Second World War, it was even worse. 2.5 million Indians in uniform. I won't belabor the point, but of Britain's total war debt of £3 billion in 1945 money, 1.25 billion was owed to India and never actually paid. Somebody mentioned Scotland. Well, fact is that colonialism actually cemented your union with Scotland. You know, the Scots had actually tried to send colonies out before 1707. They'd all failed, I'm sorry to say. But then, of course, came union, and India was available, and there you had a disproportionate employment of Scots. I'm sorry, Mr. McKenzie has to speak after me. Engaged in this colonial enterprise as soldiers, as merchants, as agents, as employees, and the earnings from India is what brought prosperity to Scotland, even pulled Scotland out of poverty. Now that India's no longer there, no wonder the bonds are loosening. Now, we've heard other arguments on this side. There's been a mention of the railways. Well, let me tell you, first of all, as my colleague, the Jamaican High Commissioner, has pointed out, railways and roads were really built to serve British interests and not those of the local people. But I might add that many countries have built railways and roads without having had to be colonized in order to do so. They were designed to carry raw materials from the hinterland into the ports to be shipped to Britain. And the fact is that the Indian or Jamaican or other colonial public, their needs were incidental. Transportation, there was no attempt made to match supply to demand for mass transport, none whatsoever. Instead, in fact, the Indian railways were built with massive incentives offered by Britain to British investors, guaranteed out of Indian taxes paid by Indians, with the result that you actually had 1 mile of Indian railway costing twice what it cost to build the same mile in Canada or Australia because there was so much money being paid in extravagant returns. Britain made all the profits, controlled the technology, supplied all the equipment, and absolutely all these benefits came as private enterprise, British private enterprise, at public risk, Indian public risk. That was the railways as an accomplishment. We're hearing about aid. I think it was again Sir Richard Otterbury mentioned British aid to India. Well, let me just point out that British aid to India is about 0.4% of India's GDP. The government of India actually spends more on fertilizer subsidies, which might be an appropriate metaphor for that argument. If I may point out as well, that as my fellow speakers from the proposition have pointed out, there have been incidents of racial violence, of loot, of massacres, of bloodshed, of transportation, in India's case, even of one of our last Mughal emperor. Yes, maybe today's Britons are not responsible for some of these depredations, but the same speakers have pointed with pride to their foreign aid. You're not responsible for the people starving in Somalia, but you give them aid. Surely the principle of reparations for the wrongs that have been done cannot be denied. It's been pointed out, for example, the dehumanization of Africans in the Caribbean, the massive psychological damage that has been done, the undermining of social traditions, of property rights, of the authority structures of these societies, all in the interests of British colonialism. And the fact remains that many of today's problems in these countries, including the persistence, in some cases, the creation of racial and ethnic and religious tensions, were the direct result of the colonial experience. So there is a moral debt that needs to be paid. Someone challenged reparations elsewhere. Well, I'm sorry, Germany doesn't just give reparations to Israel. It also gave reparations to Poland. Perhaps some of the speakers here are too young to remember the dramatic picture of Chancellor Willy Brandt on his knees in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1970. And there are other examples. There is Italy's reparations to Libya. There's Japan's to Korea. Even Britain has paid reparations to the New Zealand Maoris. So it's not as if this is something unprecedented or unheard of that's going to somehow open some sort of nasty Pandora's box. No wonder Professor Lewis reminded us that he's from Texas. There's a wonderful expression in Texas that summarizes the arguments of the opposition: all hat and no cattle. Now, If I can just quickly look through the other notes I was scribbling while they were speaking. There was reference to democracy and rule of law. Let me say with the greatest possible respect, you can, it's a bit rich to oppress, enslave, kill, torture, maim people for 200 years and then celebrate the fact that they're democratic at the end of it. We were denied democracy, sir. We had to snatch it, seize it from you. With the greatest of reluctance, it was conceded in India's case after 150 years of British rule, and that too with limited franchise. Yes, indeed, ma'am.
The opposition spoke quite highly of Greek and Athenian democracy on which the West should pride itself and spoke of liberty and equality in that same name. The Athenian democracy was only functioning because of the slave society on which it was built. That's the nature of colonization.
All right, I don't think that needs contradiction, not for me at any rate. but if I may just point out, I think the arguments made by a couple of the speakers, the first speaker, Mr. Lee in particular, conceded all the evil atrocities of colonialism, but essentially suggested that reparations won't really help, they won't help the right people, they'll be used as a propaganda tool, they'll embolden people like Mr. Mugabe. It's always nice how in the old days, you know, I'm sorry to say that the people of the Caribbean used to frighten their children into behaving and sleeping by saying Sir Francis Drake would come after them. That was a legacy of that. Now it's Mugabe will be there. So this is the new sort of Sir Francis Drake of our times. The fact is very simply, sir, that we are not talking about reparations as a tool to empower anybody. They're a tool for you to atone for the wrongs that have been done. And I am quite prepared to accept the proposition that you can't evaluate, put a monetary sum on the kinds of horrors people have suffered. Certainly no amount of money can expiate the loss of a loved one, as somebody pointed out there. You're not going to be able to figure out an exact amount. But the principle is what matters. The fact is that to speak blithely of sacrifices on both sides, as an analogy was used here, a burglar comes into your house, ransacks the place, stubs his toe, and you say, there was a sacrifice on both sides. That, I'm sorry to say, is not an acceptable argument. The truth is that we are not arguing specifically that vast sums of money need to be paid. The proposition before this House is the principle of owing reparations, not the fine points of how much is owed, to whom it should be paid. The question is there a debt? Does Britain owe reparations? As far as I'm concerned, the ability to acknowledge a wrong that has been done, to simply say sorry, will go a far, far, far longer way than some percentage of GDP in the form of aid. What is required, it seems to me, is accepting the principle that reparations are owed. Personally, I'd be quite happy if it was £1 a year for the next 200 years after the last 200 years of Britain and India. Thank you very much, Madam President.
Madam President, should we pay reparations to our former colonies? In my judgment, it would be patronising and unnecessary to do so. The world has moved on from the colonial era. Allegiances and the world economic order are changing fast. I'm reliably informed that there are only 22 countries that Britain has not invaded. We helped ourselves to their natural resources and made a tidy profit. We occupied them for the protection of our fleets, Malta, Gibraltar, and for the detention of our felons, Australia. We didn't ask the indigenous population if it was okay with them, and sometimes they objected. Sometimes they showed humility. King Lubengula of the Matabele famously started his first loyal address to Queen Victoria with the words, we who are but as lice on the edge of Her Majesty's blanket. The thing is, what are the reparations for? How do you put a value on it? Who gets it? Let me say at the outset, it wasn't all good news, as we've just been hearing. The colonial period was a phase in world development. Indigenous populations suffered loss of land, livelihood, and died in military encounters. British colonial administrators and workers also dropped like flies from malaria, dengue fever, riot, gut rot, and plenty of other things. Many of these men and women died working on infrastructure projects which improved the health and welfare of the population. Building hospitals and sewers, constructing roads and railways, putting in schools and teachers, working as doctors and nurses. There was sacrifice on both sides. So how can you construct a balance sheet that gives us a number that can be used in the compensation equation? Did Britain set back the economic prosperity and opportunity of the colonies? I don't believe that anyone can legitimately argue that we did. I won't. British administrations invested heavily in physical infrastructure, health projects, developed markets for local goods and raw materials, and legal regimes based on the British system. Some, such as Nigeria, Hong Kong, and Singapore, have become the wealthiest countries in the world. So if you have to put a value on compensation, fairness dictates that we offset the contribution that Britain made to the colony and the value of the legacy we left behind. But as I stand here at this dispatch box, looking at this familiar format, I'm reminded of another aspect of British rule which lives on in former colonies: democracy and the parliamentary process. A speaker or a president presides over a parliament. I won't, thank you. Elected MPs face each other and debate the legislative proposals before votes are taken. I've seen the same process in parliaments right across the world. Ancient Greece may have presided over the birth of democracy, but Britain has spread it far and wide. I won't, thanks. And in the post-imperial world, independent countries have not overturned it. And democracy's brother is the rule of law. Everyone is equal before it and everybody knows where they stand. I won't. The rule of law is anathema to the warlord or the local chief who may wish to run their own fiefdom through intimidation and bribery. It is ever so British, and all former colonies have kept this principle as part of their constitutions. And who would we pay this compensation to? It's quite tricky. In America, the colonists went to war against the mother country and gained their independence. And their impact on indigenous Indians is far greater than the early British settlers. The same could be said for Australia, where British colonial impact on the Aborigines was as nothing compared to the post-colonial developments. So it's not straightforward. And what should we do about the compensation for those countries who have chosen to retain the link with their former coloniser? Like the 53 nations of the Commonwealth who voluntarily recognise the Queen as their head of state. And by the way, that includes Australia, Canada, India, Malaysia and 18 African countries. And then there are 14 British overseas territories and 3 Crown dependencies. And whilst they are self-governing, they continue to recognise the Queen as their head of state. They don't have to, but they choose to. It just gets more complicated. What about Ireland? What about Scotland? How long is it going to be before Nicola Sturgeon's down here asking for her slice of the cake? I give way. Did you want to?
Well, I just wanted to point out that there are many members of the Commonwealth, including India, that have the Queen as the head of the Commonwealth, but not as head of state, as you inaccurately suggest.
Well, I'll be coming to what Britain is doing for India in just a minute. But why does that qualify them for reparations? The principle should be that reparations should be made when there is a specific injustice that needs to be remedied. And we've heard plenty of it today, like the Mau Mau in Kenya. But to ask today's taxpayers to finance reparations to the free citizens of independent states merely assuages a 21st century guilt. And Britain is already doing more than most. I'm proud of the fact that the United Kingdom is one of the few countries that has met the UN target of 0.7% of GDP. The wealthiest countries in the world are helping the poorest voluntarily, and that includes British aid to India. To demand even more is to maintain the old inferiority complex and fail to recognise what is happening. But, yes.
To refuse to recognise reparations is to maintain the same superiority complex that allowed colonialism and imperialism to happen in the first place. Moreover, your facts about Lord Benguela are wrong. In fact, there is extensive documentary evidence that Britain was responsible for the largest forced migration in the history of Matabeleland.
But why does that oblige today's generation, who were nothing to do with it, to pay compensation to people who were not, who didn't suffer from it? I won't give way anymore.
So, point of order to clarify for people who seem confused. Point of order is to draw my attention to an abuse of the forms of a house, and that is directed at the president. If you would like to make a point of information to the speaker, that is a point of information. Are you drawing my attention to an abuse of the forms of the house?
Yeah, I do.
Okay,
I think the points of information which are being raised by the greatest from both sides of the chamber are clearly intended to disrupt the debate and to undermine the right of free speech of the speakers here tonight on the opposition side.
Why don't you listen to some of the event we can
pray?
Madam President, I'm simply following what is normal in a debating society and a country believes in free speech, of making my points and allowing just a couple of interventions. I don't take offence by other people trying. After all, that's what free speech is all about. But, Madam President, it's not all one way. The Times Rich List, published last month, reveals that the wealthiest people in Britain come from the former colonies. You've all heard of the Hindujas and the Mittals. They're up there. Four of the top seven wealthiest people in Britain are from former colonies. And if you include the United States of America, 9 out of 10 of the top richest people in the world are from former colonies. It's a rough old world, but it needs a bit of give and take. We may look back and feel some regret, but we cannot endlessly re-evaluate historical events through the prism of today's values. I beg to oppose the motion.
When you think about colonization, it is the strangest thing you can think about. Because conquering is one thing. You go to another country, you take what's theirs. You want more. You take the land, you know, you take the resources, you kill the people. That I understand. But colonization, I don't condone, I understand. But colonization is strange because you go there and you don't just take over. You then force the people to become you. That is such a strange concept. When you think about where the British did it, I mean, they did it in Africa, they did it in Asia. And think about in India. Those cultures could not be more diametrically opposed. And out of nowhere, the British just decided to roll up. Imagine what the Indians must have felt like on that day. Minding your own business, walking through a field. Next thing you know, the British showed up on horseback. Hear ye, hear ye. By order of Her Majesty the Queen, we have arrived. You over there,
What is the name of this land?
This land over here? This is called India.
Well, my good man, I am here to tell you that India is now under the British Empire.
And I'm glad that I can tell you that India is exactly where it was yesterday.
No. I feel you're not understanding what I'm saying. I'm letting you know that we're here to colonize you by order of the Queen.
Who is the Queen?
The Queen. The Queen of England, the ruler of Great Britain. She who was ordained by God.
Which God?
God. The one true God.
There are many gods, my friend. What is the name of your God?
There is only one God, and his name is God, and you two shall worship him.
You want me to worship a God, but you don't want to tell me his name? What are you talking about? There are many gods, okay? There is Shiva, there is Lakshmi, there is Hare Krishna, there are many gods. What is the name of your God?
His name is God.
You don't know the name of your God?
It's just God.
Is it like mommy or daddy? You want me to worship your God, but you don't want me to tell me his name, huh? How am I going to pray to him? What do I do? Every morning I go to wake up, then I pray like, oh dear God, I was hoping that maybe God, you could help me. No, sorry, not you, other God. No, other God. No, not wrong God. No, God, I was trying to talk to other... No, you're right. I should have asked for your first name. No, God. No, other God, please. No, God behind that God. No, not you today, God. Other God, you're right. He told me he would know I was talking to and I don't... No, other God, please. That God on that... No, that God, you... Then I wonder why my prayers are not getting answered, huh?
How dare you speak to me like that? Do you know who I am?
No, because you never introduce yourself.
I have come here representing Great Britain.
And I have never heard of Great Britain. Who gave you that name? Well, we did. You called yourselves great? Isn't that a little presumptuous? Shouldn't you wait for other people to tell you how great you are? Huh? Shouldn't you just go around the world and just do good things? Then people go, oh my God, Britain, look how great you are.
Well, I beg to differ. I believe we could do it because we knew instinctively. We are Great Britain.
Well, in that case, welcome to Great India.
No, it doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. How dare you speak to me like this?
Look, you're the one who dares to speak to me, okay? I was here minding my own business in my land. You came over here riding on your skinny cow telling me that things are going to change. I don't know who you are. All I know is you are really crazy, okay? You're not feeling too right. And I didn't want to say anything, but you look like you're going to faint. In fact, it looks like you have died last week, okay? Something is very wrong with your skin. You're not looking good, my friend. Maybe you should come down. We have a curry. We talk about this.
What are you talking about? I look quite normal.
You do not look normal, my friend. I've never seen anybody with that complexion in my life, okay? You look like you're playing hide and seek with the sun your entire life. I don't know what is happening, but that is not how a person should look, huh? I can see your veins pumping through your skin right now. Do you know how creepy that is? Pumping. If I was your doctor, I don't need X-ray machine. I just go, what is problem? It is your kidney. How do I know? Because you're translucent. That is how I know.
Damn you, we are going to run this country whether you like it or not.
We are not going to do anything you tell us. You're a madman.
We are going to take it. You're not taking. We're going.
She's all yours. Take. Don't play nice. Take.
Hello, my name is Anupapal. I'm a comedian from Mumbai, India. This is my first time doing a show in the United Kingdom. I am from India. I've been here a couple of months. I'm told, Anupapal, your English is very good. You're very comprehensible. Now, here's the thing. I did not want my English to be very good. I did not even want to speak it. But 250 years ago... some British people came over to India and told us, speak like this. This is a better language. And we said, all right. We were quite impressed. You had wigs. You were cross-dressing. It was good. Fans of the empire in the house. And we were learning. You said, yeah, English is an easy language. Write down, Salisbury. He said, no, it gets easier. That was a hard one. Gets easier. Write down, Siobhan. It was going well. It was going fine. Suddenly, 1947, middle of the night, you guys just left. Just ran away. World's first Brexit. Leaving a generation of Indians, like my father, sounding like this. Like a love child of Downton Abbey and a Bangalore call centre. And we asked you, Britain, we said, what are we now in India supposed to do with this accent? You said, we don't know yet. But maybe in 60, 70 years, when your economy picks up, you've got that accent. When our credit cards don't work, you can answer our phones. Is that all right, Ramesh, or shall I call you Theodore? She's better. It's going well, though. Empire was going well for a while. You give us things we did not have. You said, India, you have a lot of malaria, disgusting, you're dying, it's horrible. Here, have some gin and tonic. We said, that's not bad, gin and tonic, these people are not bad. It's very nice people, gin and tonic. Then you said, here, have some tea. We're like, oh, this is very nice, this is our tea. What kind of treachery is this? They're selling our stuff back to us. What are they calling this scam? The British Empire. Not bad. It's not bad. But now, you know, now we're two distinctly separate countries. 70 years of Indian independence. You are a democracy. We are whatever we are. Just a billion people running around saying, give me Facebook. And now I love studying differences in our cultures. My first time in Britain for an extended period, I was surprised to find how polite your people are, and how your language works at two levels. You say a thing in the English language, it means a whole different thing. If someone says to me in Britain, Anuvab, I have a slight issue. It means I've killed their whole family. So polite. And I was reading that apparently, yesterday in the newspaper, it says Britain now has third world levels of corruption. And the accusation was two of your ministers, this was from news a little while ago, two of your ministers had gone to Sri Lanka on a business trip, had spent £5,000 more than they should have on Her Majesty's government's credit card, on personal expenses, crabs and massages. And for that, the accusation was they should be fired. This is third world levels of corruption, unacceptable in Britain. Third world levels of corruption was the accusation. Now, I know a thing or two about corruption where I'm from. It is the only thing we value above integrity. It's the first time anywhere in the world people are clapping for corruption. So I read that, and it said, accused of stealing how much? £5,000. Amateurs. 2 weeks ago, a government minister in India walked into the treasury where the money is printed, stole the machine that prints money, and put it in his house. And he wasn't fired, he was fined. Which he paid off by printing the money. When you get there, Britain, call me. Amateur, corrupt people. But you know, I like coming to Britain because Britain, I cannot lie to Britain about India. Your knowledge of geography of my country, very vast. Because, you know, most of your great-grandfathers invaded every toilet, put in the flag. You know about the world. You've been there almost too much. You know where you can lie about India? America.
I was in America, and they get very impressed by basic geography. Like, if you just know capitals of places. This lady told me, Anavab, India sounds so fascinating. We're from Ohio. We've never left. But India sounds incredible. What happens over there? What happens? A country of a billion people. The Mughal Empire, the British Empire. I could say all of that. But the only thing as an Indian person I value above corruption is being diminutive and treacherous. Diminutive is genetic. Treachery I've learned from the best. When she said, what happens over there? I could say whatever I wanted. She'd believe me. Said, my name is Anavab. In ancient Sanskrit, it means washing machine. She said, do you guys have, like, elections in a democratic government? We have a president through elections. You guys have something similar? I said, I don't know what that is, no. No, we don't have any of that. What we do is, the entire country is run by the app Uber. So every time you need a government, you just click on the app. Whoever locally volunteers, he's your prime minister. You know why you're clapping, right? You in Britain are thinking, that's a pretty good system of government. Let's open the apps. Who is our prime minister this week? I don't know who's around in SW1. It's like that. It's not a bad system. But she carried on. They were lovely, though, in America. You see, because I think some cultures think certain things are specific to their country, whereas most things are now universal and global. You know, I live in New India now. New India. A billion people, 800 million of them under the age of 30, all wanting to work for Google. It's like living inside a search engine. Everybody's young, they're all millennials. And millennial Indian people, they don't have real names anymore. Indian names derived from Sanskrit. Abhishek, Rajiv, derived from Sanskrit. Now it's just noises. Black blue, flat white. Every person, Indian person's name sounds like a cafe in Reykjavik. It's just noises. And it's very hard if you live in a very digital tech country, wants to be the leader of the world in tech. It's hard for old people. My mother is 75. She just signed up for Twitter. Under pressure of the culture. She said, no, I'm on Twitter. And she started following celebrities, Hollywood and Bollywood celebrities. And she thought, lovely thought, at 75, the moment you're following these people, you are friends with them. I did not correct her. The actor Hugh Grant, who she follows, wrote on Twitter, hey Mumbai, catch me next week, coming for a UNICEF conference. My mother wrote back right away, can't come. Busy. Change the date, Hugh. Fantastic. But before I leave you, I have to tell you this. This is my first time in Britain, and I'm quite taken. Before I left, my wife said, listen, you're very fat. You're going to be an embarrassment to all of India. Go for yoga. Try and lose some weight. Go for yoga. Now, here's the thing. I went to a yoga clinic in Mumbai. And here's the thing. I've realized when I come here how much yoga has become our greatest export. And I have to tell you this, London, yoga was not invented in an espresso shop in Shoreditch. Yoga was invented in 4 BC when accidentally an old Indian man found his right leg on the back of his head. Looked around and said, you know what, there's a business here. But my yoga, this is how global the world is, but my yoga teacher in Mumbai, where we invented the thing, was a British lady. We outsourced it to you, you outsourced it back. Her name was Emma. She said, "None of you Indian husbands are fat." The class was filled with fat, obese husbands. All walking around going, "Your wife sent you." "You're fat. You're disgusting." And she said, "None of you are fat. All your wives are body shaming you." We said, "Okay, we're not fat. What are we?" She said, "You are oysters in a beautiful ocean. And what you have is not a belly, but a covering to hide the pearl inside you, you beautiful oyster." And we said, "This is how they conquered India." Ladies and gentlemen, you make that better. Been a delightful audience. I would have loved to have stayed, but I'm in London for one more day and I have to run to the British Museum to pick up some of my granddad's things. So I don't...
And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, thank the whites, you know you don't.